right, everyone. It's Thursday, January 23rd. It wasn't too late last night. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I got to go to sleep at a reasonable hour because I think at around 10 or 10:30 they quit with the impeachment hearing. So amazing. I'm spending way too much time trying to, you know, multitask, listening to the television set and doing my homework and doing everything else. But once again, Adam Schiff, absolutely his stem winder at the very end was – I was in tears. And I actually did a tweet. I made my tweet of the day, everyone, based on what he had said. And what he said was, the president's misconduct cannot be decided at the ballot box, for we cannot be assured that the vote will be fairly won. That is just – that is the whole
point.
It's chilling. And I had John Nichols on this morning. I taped him. Mm-hmm. And one of the things – and I even talked to Scott Braddock about it. The only sad part I feel about these impeachment hearings is obviously they have to do a lot of repetition because they're building the case. They're not sure when the American people are going to be tuning in, let alone the senators who don't necessarily want to be tuning in. But Adam Schiff is the only one who's compelling. The others are not. And I am just surprised that Nancy Pelosi didn't appreciate the theater of the moment. You know, I know she went from here and this litigator and this person, this geographic distribution and this, you know, this diversity, women, men, whatever. But in the end, what is more important than all of that, because no one's Googling people's names as they're talking, is someone who can get up there and tell a passionate story. And in part, Adam Schiff, I said, needs an echo chamber. And they were not his echo chamber. So not only did he stand out as being alone, but he was a kind of alone because he's the best storyteller, and yet the story is so compelling.
Yeah. He tells the story with lots of facts, and he explains them in ways that people can understand, and he ties the facts to the law, if you will, grounds for impeachment, to show that these facts do meet the standard that the Constitution has for impeachment. What I found most compelling last night, Arnie, in addition to obviously Schiff's speech, but did you notice when he finished, there was silence in that chamber? Nobody said a word for
it was
15
incredible.
Seconds. It was incredible. Because, even the Chief Justice just sat there.
Because he spoke to your love of country. He spoke to your understanding of what is right and what is wrong. That's really what that was. It isn't about the law. It isn't about impeachment. It's about doing right.
Right.
And I wanted to jump up and applaud because I just want people to – that's what this is. This is so much bigger than a moment in the United States. And it's bigger than the impeachment. It's about having the understanding, the spine – you know, that this is, you know, I want to write a book called The Spine is a Terrible Thing to Waste.
Yeah.
And I look at all those senators and thinking, where is yours? Where is your love of your children? Where's your sense of generational ethics? This isn't just about the now. It's about the future.
Right. Well, you know, my mantra has always been do the right thing. And I think that Schiff did a wonderful job of getting through maybe not getting through because who knows what goes on in the minds of the Republican senators, but making them think about the fact that, yes, it's more than just political. It's more than just your own career and tying in, you know, Vindman and Hill.
That they risk their lives. They risk their careers. What are you risking?
And
you're elected
career,
to do this.
Yeah. So try to think about doing what's right and being somewhat heroic in addition to thinking about whether Donald Trump's going to squash you in the next election.
Well, I think what's amazing to me is that it's not even about doing – being that we're not asking for heroism. They were elected not only to represent their constituents, to protect the nation. Mm-hmm. the nation. If it turns out the president of the United States is putting the nation at risk, it is not a heavy lift. It is wrong. It is wrong. This isn't about liking Donald Trump. This has got nothing to do with likability. It is about risking our nation, risking the integrity of the vote, risking our security. He is putting it all at risk because of his ego. It is not worth it. It is not worth it. They only earn $130,000 a year or whatever it is they get. So it's not like they're getting a big paycheck. I understand their egos are getting stroked. But in the end, what do they have to stroke when they see what's happened to our country? you know, and our standing in the world. Oh, my God.
Right. That was pretty compelling, and I don't know how many Republicans are going to be moved by it, but I hope they are.
Well, you know, even Lindsey Graham had to congratulate him.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Lindsey Graham, for that moment, John McCain was channeling in his head, going, what are you doing?
Yeah, for that moment, Lindsey Graham actually thought about what it was like when he had a spine.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. Exactly. Anyway, so, real quick, so what's going on with you?
And then quick, we'll do what I to mention was the story that came out about Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, of Saudi Arabia, hacking Jeff Bezos' phone. So here he is, you know, the wealthiest billionaire, owns Amazon and the Washington Post. And this guy, MBS, is so brutal and so powerful that just like he could murder Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist, and dismember his body, MBS could also hack Bezos' phone and put out information about his affair, get his wife to divorce him and make his life miserable. So MBS is demonstrating what powerful authoritarians will do to like go after the Washington Post in this case or any opponent that apps them, that talks about what they're doing that is unjust.
But wasn't he in conversation on the phone with Bezos?
That's how he hacked. He had one conversation.
Right. Yeah. So here's my question. How could Bezos be so out to lunch to think that he could somehow have a conversation and not protect himself and not realize – I mean, this is a guy who's willing to dismember, you know, a person that writes for his paper, and you would think that he's not going to dismember you as well?
Well, I think the conversation between MBS and Bezos was a couple of years ago. I don't know if that was before or after they murdered Khashoggi.
Was it before?
Yeah, but yeah. I don't know if it was before. I do know that it was before this year. It was quite a while ago. But my point about this, though, is it's really disconcerting. It's a worldwide phenomenon that people in power, authoritarians and Donald Trump, who's an authoritarian but elected, are doing to their opponents. It's basically shut down anybody that either calls out facts that are true, opposes your policy, anybody that doesn't put out a message that you like, and especially the media, you just shut them down. You know, Bibi Netanyahu does that, Modi in India.
President Trump.
And Trump, obviously, yeah. Yeah. And it's got to scare you what the power is that they have with just technology. And I tie this to Russia's invading our election in 2016 and using Facebook and the bots. And, you know, 20 years before that, Harry Hersey was showing how easy it was to hack into those electronic voter machines. Right. I mean, we got to think about the fact that we've got to protect ourselves from this.
It's just like a form of terrorism, right?
It's absolutely terrorism.
Right. But here's my problem. When your domestic terrorist is your president.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that out loud again.
You got to impeach him.
I mean, thank you. Thank you. And on that note, we better do reparation. Oh, my God. There's too much to talk about, everyone. It's just – I feel like it's such a roller coaster. But before we grab our writer from The Guardian, a really interesting story, an amazing story about Evanston, Illinois. I also want to share with you – so WBUR had a poll that came out this morning. And the poll this morning was looking at New Hampshire. And the poll went from December of 2019 to January of 2020. And the most remarkable part of the story in this poll with WBUR is that Bernie Sanders went from, I think, 14 or 15 to 29%. Unbelievable jump. Unbelievable jump. And we had this conversation. You'll hear it tomorrow with John Nichols as we did a little analysis because he read the crosstabs in the poll. But I put up for today at the Attitudes page on Facebook about another political polling number. And the political polling number was from the National Morning Consult. It's a GE poll among independents. So this is a national poll. The poll on WBUR, everyone, was a state poll of New Hampshire because our primary is coming up very quickly. But this is what was interesting among independents. Listen to this. Sanders versus Trump among independents. Sanders, 42%. Trump, 32%. Bloomberg among independents, 38%, Trump, 32%. Biden, 39%, Trump, 34%. Warren, 38%, Trump, 33%. And Buttigieg is neck and neck, 35% to Trump, 34% among independents. I just wanted to point this out to everyone as we talk about electability during the course of the rest of the day and this afternoon. But these independent numbers are fascinating. And among independents, Sanders, 42% to Trump, 32%. He comes in number one among independents. And, of course, you saw the WBUR poll this morning. Coming in number one in New Hampshire, doubling his support in New Hampshire to 29%. Ooh. All right. So what I want to talk about, however, is a story that I read at The Guardian. The title of the story at The Guardian was the following: Reparations, One City's Reparations Program That Could Offer a Blueprint for the Nation. Evanston, Illinois is levying a tax on newly legalized marijuana to fund projects benefiting African Americans in recognition of the enduring effects of slavery and the war on drugs. Mm. Joining us right now is Eric Luntz. He's a freelance journalist, and his work has appeared in The Guardian, The Hive, whatever. And you wrote about this. And I just thought, as I said to you when you said, what should we be talking about? Obviously, your piece is our roadmap. But what is so exciting is we have been talking about reparations. Oh, maybe we'll study it. Oh, we'll do this. And this is a huge step. This isn't a conversation. This is actually trying to define how you do it, with a revenue stream to actually do it. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure. So talk to me a little bit about this story. I went to the city of Evanston, Illinois' website, and I just want everyone to know that at the city of Evanston's website, they actually have this section called The Definition of Reparations, What a Resolution Will Look Like, What's Next. So this is not just a story in The Guardian or in The Washington Post. You actually go to their website, and it's actually articulated in the city's website.
Yeah, this is something that they've been really transparent about because they do hope that this is something that catches on. You know, I think that that website is largely, you know, obviously it is geared toward the residents there so they can learn about it.
Right.
But I also think it's a secondary message to the nation where, you know, if you're a municipality considering something like this, this is a project that you can take on as well.
So tell me a little bit about the history. Why did Evanston, of all the places, why did Evanston suddenly sort of come to Jesus on this issue and say, you know what, we've been talking about reparations, we're going to do reparations? Is it because they suddenly had this stream of income and they were trying to figure out how do we use this in a creative way? Was there a backstory in Evanston where this conversation had been maybe had at the public library or something, you know, they have, you know, city talks?
Mm-hmm.
Where did it come from and how could it have translated into this in a fairly interesting time frame?
Yeah, so I think it's the confluence of all the factors that you just kind of alluded to. You know, some background on Evanston for any listeners who might not be familiar. It's a suburb, very populous, directly bordering Chicago to the north.
Okay.
So it's very populous. It's similar to Chicago politically in that it tends to be pretty blue and liberal. It's similar to Chicago in that it is more diverse than certainly many other suburbs would be. And, you know, because it's home to Northwestern University, it's home to a lot of culture, students,
right,
academics. But one thing that it also does share with Chicago is that it is home to very pronounced segregation. You know, Chicago is one of the most segregated cities in the country. And Evanston is very segregated as well, and that's really what this initiative is aimed at addressing. So Robin Rue Simmons is a member of the city council in Evanston, and this was something that she had really spearheaded. Basically, in interviews, what she told me is that this began a little more than a year ago, and
wow,
she was concerned as she watched, you know, the city try these various projects, do all this various inclusion work, and yet these racial disparities that stem from, of course, longstanding injustices, as well as more recent and ongoing issues like redlining, these racial disparities were not closing, but were in fact increasing. You know, I think a startling fact about Evanston is that from 2000 to 2017, its black population decreased by about 5%.
Mm-hmm.
So they were losing citizens. There's gaps in education. There's gaps in housing. There's gaps in life expectancy. And so she wanted to find ways to more concretely address this issue.
Now, can I stop you here? Look, curious, because you mentioned Northwestern, which so that in a lot of ways, this academic institution has a huge shadow over the community of Evanston, which it certainly does. Okay. So that in a way that I'm beginning to process why Evanston. Is Robin Ruth Simmons, does she have a connection to the college? She's a city councilor, I know that. But I'm kind of curious, what's her history that she brings to the table? Obviously, she can read the changing demographics. She understands the community. She's a city councilor. But is there a town and gown connection as they begin to look at how to address this inequity?
I think it's more just that she's been on the city council for a couple of years, and this is – you know, I think what has made her the unique person to spearhead this is that she's kind of tapped into some of the history of the city council. Years earlier, there had been a resolution in support of H.R. 40, which is the bill that the late John Conyers has introduced in every session of Congress since 1989. This is also something that Sheila Jackson Lee has also been really instrumental in, and she continues to introduce that in Congress. It was a resolution that supported that bill, which would study reparations on the federal level, but not implement anything. But where Robin Ruth Simmons differed here, or where she built on that, rather, is that she wanted something that had some concrete action attached to it. So throughout the summer, they studied this issue, and in the fall they had town halls on the subject, including one that featured Danny Glover. In November they passed, I think it was November or December, they passed this resolution 8-1, so very overwhelmingly supported, in favor of instituting this reparations program that, as you said at the top, is funded by the newly legalized marijuana sales tax.
So the city council passed it. They obviously were very transparent. They brought the community in. How much money are we talking about that do they think with this tax coming in from the sale of marijuana? And how is the community feeling about that? Because like every community, they see this money as a pot of gold. And they're looking at, oh, we can fix our infrastructure. Oh, we can fix our education. Oh, we can fix this. Were they able to sell them with the idea that, yes, this revenue stream is new, it may be vibrant, but if we introduce this into reparations, it will have a multiplier effect. You know what I mean? So it's not necessarily specifically related to housing or education or whatever, but by recognizing what is sort of holding us down, we're enhancing the entire city by making this investment.
Yeah. So first of all, to answer the first part of your question, this is big money that we're talking about. Since Illinois began legal pot sales, on the first of this year, there have been lines out the door. They've been having trouble keeping it in stock. City officials in Evanston estimate that the potential tax revenue on a yearly basis is going to be $500,000 to $750,000. So this is not just a little bit of money. Mm-hmm. This isn't just pennies going in. This is significant money, and they plan to gather $10 million over the course of 10 years, but they believe that it's possible that they'll be able to accumulate that money beforehand. Now, they're also talking about bringing in some outside sources here, whether it's Northwestern, whether it's banks, whether it's outside investors who can also contribute to this fund. And again, right now the total pot is considered $10 million, but I think that's subject to change too as they continue going along with this. I think in terms of how the community views it, I think they've been generally very supportive, with a couple of exceptions. Of course, anytime you do something like this, you are making yourself vulnerable to, the kind of vitriol that you might expect. So Robin Ruth Simmons has gotten hate mail and threats,
It's part of the job.
Right,
okay.
Exactly. Right. Whether that's from the community or not. But there's also some within the community that aldermen have described to me as, concerned that kind of a believe it when I see it type of thing, where there's some people who could benefit from this potentially benefit from this initiative, but who don't, who are skeptical that it will work, because I think that we've seen so many promises go unfulfilled. I think what's different this time, or what's unique about this program, is the funding and the fact that the money is there, the money is guaranteed, and is a very reliable source.
So I have a question. So are they going to wait until the pot gets to 10 million before they decide to make those investments? Are they going to be draining the pot even as the pot gets filled? And as they're talking through this transparent conversation with their community, what are the triggers for where they make the investment? Is it healthcare that's the trigger? Is it housing that's the trigger? Is it like, you know, Andrew Yang sending them $1,000 a month?
Yeah.
How are they exact? Well, you have to think about this because, you know, Martin Luther King talked about, you know, that uniform income. So I'm trying to figure out what's on the plate or the smorgasbord that they're looking at as to how to address reparations, because it isn't something like a switch. You turn it on, you turn it off.
Right, exactly. It's complicated business, and
very complicated.
Part of what's going on right now is the reparations subcommittee is trying to determine how best to implement these measures, how best to use this money so that resources are getting to people who need it. Right now, the plan is to begin distributing these funds at the earliest possible point, which could be later this year, it could be early next year. Mm-hmm. But the aldermen I've spoken to are also eager to get this going and would love to find ways to get this money out as soon as it becomes available to them, perhaps by the middle of this year. So a lot of that is still up in the air because the committee is trying to determine what the best course of action is here. They're consulting with experts, they're planning to consult with the community. The idea is to find the best way for Evanston to make use of this money, and it could be a mixed bag of things. Of course, on the national level and just in the discussion about reparations, we've seen everything from, as you said, a basic income type model,
right,
to specific investments in healthcare or resources or housing.
I'm going to be a little sobering. So, Eric, don't think I'm a jerk here. But as I'm listening to this, I love it. I love it. I want us to stop talking and I want us to start doing. But I'm going to go to the state of Vermont. The state of Vermont at one point in time thought that they were going to create some kind of Medicare for all, just for the little state of Vermont. The state of Vermont is 600,000 people. It's the size of a suburb. I don't know how big Evanston is, but it's also a suburb, probably bigger than the state of Vermont. Is one of the questions and challenges for Evanston, how do we do this on such a tiny scale? How do we figure out how long someone has to live in Evanston before they sort of can participate in these reparations? I mean, part of the problem is sometimes you want to hold on to everyone and do it at once. And can you do it in such small little chunks?
Those are all the logistical concerns that face Evanston and has faced reparations, potential reparations programs in other communities. And to the extent that we've had this conversation at the federal level, that's something that's been an issue there.
Right.
I think the fact that they are discussing it and working toward this in a very concrete way is progress. And I think that's where it becomes a model for other municipalities.
What works
in Evanston might not work in, a community elsewhere. But I think that, moving it from the theoretical to the concrete, moving it from the philosophical to, the logistical is progress, because the logistics are one thing, but the fear of spending political capital on this, or just the fear of confronting these issues and all the things that reparations implies about America, that has been, I think, as big, if not bigger, a challenge to really seeing any kind of progress.
So I can't remember his name. I can't believe I'm having a mind fart here. But there's a book called The Color of Law. And what I would recommend to Evanston is that they read it in every classroom, that every city councilor gets it, because if people want to understand the need for reparations, they have to understand what we have done legally to create the kind of segregation, to create the kind of, disinvestment within the African-American community. We did it through policy. And that's why the color of law is so important, because then it obligates us to change because we actually helped to create it. We massaged it through policy, and now we have to undo it. And you just don't undo it by doing a magic wand. You have to undo it by making the right investments and changing the laws.
And the color of money talks about the national level, too. Yes. It's the country that did it and the country that really should solve it, because one problem that Evanston's going to have is everybody, all people who are descended from slaves will move to Evanston in order to take advantage of this.
Well, and that's the question.
And you talked earlier, Evan, about the black population decreasing over the last several years. The people that moved out of Evanston, who presumably are the better off people because you said the income went down. Are they going to say, I should get some of this, too?
I should come back, yeah. Eric, I'm proud of them. I can think of every reason why not to do it. But you know what? They're taking the risk to do it, and we have to just marvel at that. So,
yeah, congratulations.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you. Eric Lutz writes for The Guardian newspaper, the title of the piece, One City's Reparations Program That Could Offer a Blueprint for the Nation. And depending on what happens in 2020, blueprints might be the thing that we're looking at. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us. Take care.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day when 20 laborers who were part of the Civilian Conservation Corps got involved in a type of labor they probably never expected. The Civilian Conservation Corps was a program established by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to get young men back to work during the Great Depression. The program employed men ages 18 to 26 to complete public works projects across the nation. CCC crews planted nearly 3 billion trees, constructed 470 fire towers, built 97,000 miles of fire roads, and constructed facilities at 800 parks across the nation. But snowy weather had ground work to a halt in Allegheny County, Maryland. The men of Company 324 were at the 15 Mile Creek camp waiting for the weather to clear. That's when they received a distress call. A woman was trapped due to the snow. She was in labor, but the 3 mile long access road where she lived was impassable. Even worse, the state's snowplows were busy digging out other roads. The men of the CCC answered the call. 20 volunteers shoveled the snow by hand, working well into the night so the trapped woman could make it to the hospital to deliver her baby. In total, 30,000 young men working in 200-man crews participated in the CCC in Maryland from 1933 to 1942. Due to its proximity to Washington, D.C., the state was designated the first core area. The CCC men helped to build campgrounds, pavilions, and hiking and skiing trails that greatly enhanced the recreation landscape of that state. But for one woman, they were remembered for helping her when she needed it most, during the birth of her child on a snowy day in January. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Did you know that when you vote for president, you're actually not voting for your candidate?
I'm Tom Hartman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
Sorry if this is unsettling news, but what's really happening is that you're voting for electors to the Electoral College who have pledged to vote for your candidate and will, presumably, if your candidate wins the popular vote. It's a winner-take-all system, usually statewide, although in Maine and Nebraska, each congressional district decides one electoral vote. But sometimes electors don't vote as they had promised to do. Indeed, in 2016, 7 so-called faithless electors, 5 pledged to Trump and 2 to Clinton, jumped ship and voted for neither of those candidates, which didn't matter because the Electoral College vote wasn't that close. But in another year, a switch in a handful of electoral votes could actually decide who becomes president. In 2000, for example, the final Electoral College vote was 271 for Bush, 266 for Gore. Historical precedent supports the idea that electors indeed can change their mind and vote for whoever they please. That said, the Supreme Court, which previously has never decided this issue, has just taken a case from Washington State which raises it precisely. A decision is expected by June, way better, to be sure, than the case being before the court in November, when the electoral outcome could hang in the balance.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because democracy and advocacy begin with you, and freedom can't defend itself.
Yeah, yeah. are gonna pay the price someday. Hypocrites, all of you hypocrites, you're gonna pay the price someday. Words you speak from your mouth, but your heart is telling lies. Oh, hypocrite, you better watch out.
Hypocrites, better watch out. Let me think. All right, this is The Attitude with Artie Arnison, producer Ken Barnes. So which hypocrites are we talking about, Ken? I'm just trying to figure it out.
Well, there are so many.
There are so many.
Let me count the ways. This is Jimmy Cliff, by the way, and I was thinking of the Republicans in the Senate and Congress and their henchman, Cipollone from the White House, saying, gee, the poor Republicans didn't have a chance to participate in the House hearing.
He's a man of his word, Donald Trump. And I'm thinking, which word?
Yeah, right.
Unbelievable.
Oh my God.
It's been amazing.
Such hypocrites.
All right. Joining us as he does every Thursday from the great state of Iowa. He's in Nevada, Iowa, I believe. As he looks out on his farm with all the snow is, in fact, Stefan Schmidt. Welcome to the program, Stefan. How are you? Oh, we got him.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yes, we can hear you now.
Oh, yes. It's the winter weather interfering with our communications.
Oh, is that what it is? So let me
just... it's snow and ice and freezing rain. Anyway, it reminds us how hard it is to participate in politics during the winter in the Iowa caucuses.
Well, actually, I said the other day, I think I said it with you last week, that now that 17-year-olds can participate in the Iowa caucus, no matter how bad it is, they have no excuse for not showing up because they can sled, snowshoe, snowmobile. They'll get there. And in addition to which, tell me what Iowa State did so that 35,000 students can now actually participate in the caucus. There was a story that came out about his college, university.
Yeah,
so tell me about that.
The real problem is there are all these new election laws where you have to prove who you are and where you live and that you're eligible to vote where you are. And Iowa State issues a student ID card, but it often had either a poor picture, sometimes no picture, and it didn't have an expiration date on it or graduation date. And so those cards couldn't be one of the, in addition to some other document, used for students to vote. So the university complied with the requirements and quickly issued new student ID cards that have all the information necessary so that students now can use that Iowa State card in addition to proving that they live in the district, in the county or precinct. And that is very helpful.
So let me ask a naive question. Was this because there were sort of voter suppression bills that were coming in through Iowa and therefore was making it more challenging for students to participate? So in response to these voter suppression laws, Iowa State then reissued the student ID so students would not be challenged in participating in the caucus. So is this really new voters in the sense of these are, oh, wow, we've never had 35,000 of these young people in Iowa State voting, or now we're getting around the voter suppression laws because we've reissued the voter your ID for Iowa State so there won't be any question whether our students can participate in the caucus?
Actually, a lot of students, of course, have driver's license, Iowa driver's licenses, and live here. So of the 36,000 ISU students, a very large percentage are Iowan, and so they wouldn't have a problem. But it's for students who come from other states and maybe are living in Ames and going to Iowa State. And the answer is Secretary of State Paul Pate, whom I know quite well, would not call it voter suppression. He would say it's just voter security. It's just to make sure that we don't have a lot of people from south of the border trucked in to vote and distort.
No, that's New Hampshire, and the south of the border,
border
is Massachusetts. Yeah, exactly.
Nebraska.
Right. Well, you have that problem.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Those people from those, yeah. Anyway, so, you know, it's just, it can, but look, Arnie, as things change, you have to respond to them and try to comply. You know, if people move precincts around to confuse voters, then the party that is going to be at a loss for that has basically can counteract that by going out and finding all their voters and saying, we will get you to your polling place. The Democrats are doing that in Iowa, by the way, this year. They've got a massive effort. The Republicans as well. First of all, 100% accessibility for handicapped and others. And number two, they will take you to your polling place. They will pick you up. They're making a big effort to make it possible for people to vote. And I think that's how you overcome the efforts to basically, unless it's purging voting lists, you know, voter registration and taking away people's voting rights who should not be taken off those lists. That's very difficult, and that needs to be settled in the courts. But,
so let me just say something. I saw something the other day, and I had never seen this before. Yeah. It was at USA Today. So I pulled up my USA Today, and USA Today is doing this voter outreach thing where you can actually go to the USA Today website, and you can push, are you registered? Have you been purged? How do you register? So it has made it seem for all 50 states. So
yes, I sent it to my students.
It's incredible.
I have 200 students this semester.
Yep.
And I sent them that particular link because that is really user-friendly. All they have to do is type in basically their address, and it will tell them where they can vote, and then also the other things that you mentioned. So,
well, so I would,
you know,
I would to me, it would be incredible. So what I would be doing is I would be canvassing with my laptop or my iPad, and I would go to house and go, are you registered? You don't know? Okay, let's type this in. And it would be so helpful because even as they're being purged, you would know instantly, you were purged yesterday. Can I help you re-register? So in a lot of ways, what the USA Today is doing is such a phenomenal thing. And I just wanted everyone to know about it because I would love to see every newspaper in the country replicate or participate with the USA Today. Because if I don't get USA Today, I don't know about it. If I got the Concord Monitor, I might know about it. And I would love to see all the papers getting together to make sure that people know how they can exercise the franchise and then be supported in doing that. So even as they're purging votes, you can get them back on in seconds.
Can I ask a question about that? Do either of you know how one can re-register, as you put it, Arnie? Because once you've been purged, you don't know you've been purged. And then if you and I go out canvassing with our computers and tell people they've been purged, it may be too late past the deadline to re-register.
Depends on the state, right?
I mean,
Iowa is a same-day registration. So in Iowa, you can go to a caucus and not be registered to vote. And if you bring all your documents with you, you can register to vote.
But of course,
other states, you have to register a month before,
like
or
New Hampshire.
More, you know. So this is a country where I'm actually doing the Constitution and federalism in my American government class. And federalism is wonderful, but it also gets to be really confusing. I think Arnie mentioned that, you know, with reparations or any other thing, you have 50 states and you have thousands of communities. Yep. And so sometimes, you know, you jump from one place to another and the rules are different. So
that's just
the price we pay for federalism.
Well, and even as we talk about federalism, and every state has different sort of election laws, the beauty of what USA Today is doing is that the election is until November of 2020. And you might miss the primary, you might miss a caucus, but you won't miss the election if you go check on. And so as they're purging, and it's almost the kind of thing where you keep reminding people, did you check? Here's how you check. Let me help you check. And even if it's a month you had to, you know, from now, this gives people, I think, the timeliness that, frankly, Stacey Abrams, in a lot of ways, this feels like it mirrors what Stacey Abrams is trying to do because of what she saw happen to her and her vote in Georgia. She is trying to take that story nationally. And what the USA Today is doing is actually aiding and abetting that. And I thought that needs to be applauded.
I think that's right. I think it's a wonderful step forward. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about what's going on in Iowa. So I mentioned this a couple of times. WBUR just had a poll out. Bernie Sanders soared to number one. He doubled his support from like 15% to 29%. Nobody saw any kind of jump like that, but Bernie did. What we learned is undecideds have moved to Bernie. Okay, that's what's happened in the last month. What's happening in Iowa? I don't know how much polling is getting done, but there was this piece that Mayor Pete seems to be really sort of creeping up there. And obviously he has almost the landscape to himself up until the caucus because of what's going on with impeachment. So tell me a little bit about what you're seeing going on there.
Well, you know, it's kind of a slow jiggling of the numbers. And you still have basically four or five people at the top. And Bernie Sanders now looks like he's either – number one, or he's caught up, catching up with Joe Biden and with Elizabeth Warren and others. And there's still 40%, Arnie, there's still 40% of Iowa caucus goers who are undecided.
Yeah.
So there's a huge amount of room for that kind of movement. And yes, Mayor Pete is moving up, but, you know, he's moving up fairly slowly. And the new rules of the caucuses, we don't know what they're going to do. You had a wonderful journalist from The Atlantic on the other day, and I've been talking to her today about what the new rules of the caucuses will do. And that's right. You still have to have 15% viability. If you don't have 15% of the people in your precinct supporting, let's say, Mayor Pete, then he is not viable in that particular precinct. It's really complicated. And I think we're all biting our nails, frankly, as to what the outcome will be on caucus night. The biggest problem is now that there are going to be three different numbers reported on caucus night, Arnie. First of all, Democrats going to caucuses now have to declare as they walk into the caucus who they're going to support.
Initially,
as they walk in. And if they support, let's say, Bernie Sanders, they have to vote for him on the first round in that precinct. Then they can change their mind in the second count when the realignment occurs. And so there would be a second vote at that point. And then there is a mathematical formula that's used in each precinct to calculate the number of delegate equivalents that might come out of that precinct. So on caucus night, the media is going to have to report three different outcomes. I think it's going to be chaos. Frankly.
Well, let me just say something.
It's going to be horribly confusing.
Well, let me just say something. But what you get from those three numbers is persuadability. Because you come in and you got this many people for Bernie and this many people for Biden and this many people for Amy, and you know what the numbers look like the minute they walk in the door. Then yeah, what you get with that second round of numbers is you get to understand who is able to make the better sell. Who's able to bring the Biden people over to the Amy people or the Amy?
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, what you're also going to get is how effective is the ground game of a lot of those candidates, how well they have taught their people, because caucuses are actually more sophisticated than primaries. I'm going to walk into the voting booth and no one's going to talk me into anything because I got to pick up my pencil. That's all I got to do. I got to talk myself into it. In the caucus, it's about other people using the power of persuasion, and you're going to really get who was able to be the most effective in persuading people to sort of move from their candidate to my candidate. That, to me, tells a very powerful story, both about organization and about how they're marketing and selling their candidate.
And Elizabeth Warren is the most organized. She came on the ground and hired a lot of really great people. They have been canvassing. There is now a new thing that is growing. It was there before, but it's growing enormously, which is the people who go door to door and come to Democrats or independents and say, are you going to the caucuses? Please, you know, who are you going to support? Would you like to sign this pledge? And they have a clipboard with an official looking card on it. You pledge to vote for Elizabeth Warren.
Wow.
Thank you so much. We'll see you at your precinct. Those cards are not legal. The person can then just throw it away. It doesn't matter. But apparently when people sign a card like that, it's like they're taking an oath, like they're pledging.
Yeah.
And so the canvassers are trying to basically get as many people as possible to sign the little pledge card.
Right.
And that's fascinating, too. You know, it's kind of using guilt to make people make a decision way before the caucus even happens.
Well, it was interesting. We had one of the organizers from Iowa come on the air with us a couple of weeks ago. And he's with, the ICC or the Iowa, whatever that group is in Iowa, the very progressive group. And what I found absolutely mind-blowing was I had never heard an analysis of Pete Buttigieg that was so negative and so effective as what he was able to do. And what I saw with Sean Sebastian was that is the power of when they go into the caucus with that laundry list of this is why my candidate is so much better than yours. Yeah, your guy seems good on paper, but let me tell you about this person's connection to this big money interest. Let me tell you about this person. When he got done, I was like, like, I learned more from him in 5 minutes than I had in all the time I've been doing research about, you know, Pete Buttigieg. And that gives you an idea, again, about the persuadability of what goes on in caucuses.
But then doesn't it come down to really who you have in your team in the caucus? For instance, mm-hmm. Arnie, you were talking about it's about you can actually persuade someone. But if I have Adam Schiff in my caucus, in my precinct, and you only have Jerry Nadler in yours, you know, guess who's going to persuade the most people?
That's right. I want the Adam Schiff.
And, you're right.
But, and to be honest with you, if I were strategic, I would find my Adam Schiffs and make sure that every campaign had their Adam Schiffs. You know, as you can't spread them around because they have to go to a particular caucus site. That's because of geography. But you would be able to.
1,700 different precincts.
1,700?
Oh my God.
So how is the impeachment trial undermining what's happening in Iowa? Iowa happens so quickly. I feel like, you know, it really still is mano a mano. Retail politics is still important in Iowa. How are they doing knowing that they can't physically be there?
Look, do you really think that there is a single Democrat in Iowa who will go to the caucuses who doesn't know who Bernie Sanders is or Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren?
Exactly.
The answer is no. Candidates have been here since a year ago. They've been campaigning. Every Iowan who is going to a caucus has met them at least twice. They know every position that every one of those candidates
takes. And not
takes.
That much changes.
I don't think it's going to have much of an impact.
But you know what will have an impact?
They have surrogates that are coming. They have email. They have video streaming that they can watch.
They have ads.
They can go to websites.
Right.
They have local surrogates. For example, here in Story County, every single one of the Democrats that's still running has very articulate people who are respected and known locally who are going to these meetings and saying, remember, and are showing videos and doing showing little interviews. I just don't think it's going to have that much of an impact.
I think what actually is going to have more of an impact is not whether they're physically there, but some of the pollings that's been coming out nationally, the BUR poll in New Hampshire that shows Bernie doubling his numbers, the poll that came out that I put in on my Facebook page about how well Bernie does against Trump among independents.
Right.
So the whole thing that you're hearing now is it's not the candidates that are going to be able to say I'm electable. It's what is sort of happening outside of Iowa, outside of New Hampshire, that will convince Iowans, oh, he's electable, or oh, she's electable, because they're seeing these sort of changing numbers. My one question is, I saw an ad. Someone called me the other day and said, I just saw an ad on WMUR, the only TV station in our state, Channel 9. I mean, we have CNN and cable and all those other stations, but the only technical TV station for New Hampshire, there were ads for Mayor Bloomberg. Now, Bloomberg is not on the ballot. Bloomberg is technically not running in any of the four initial primaries or caucuses. Could someone, like in New Hampshire, Bloomberg could be a write-in. Could Bloomberg be the equivalent of a write-in for a caucus?
Yeah, there's no ballot. You go in there and you say, well, I think Bloomberg can probably beat Donald Trump, and you get 15%, 16%, 17% of the people in each of those precincts, and Bloomberg, you know, is viable. Sure.
Is he running ads in Iowa? He started to run ads in New Hampshire.
I've seen one ad. He's not really, you know, he's saying, look, I'm not running in Iowa, so don't expect me to show any numbers there. But I think he's hoping, you know, that some people will say, you know. Let me go back, though, to what we were talking about by you know, who can beat Trump and so on. The really big problem the Democrats have is that there are two different narratives. One is, as you know, and as you talked with Elaine about it, progressives are saying you got to have big ideas and really talk not just about beating Trump, but about changing America and making it better. The other narrative is people are nervous and frightened, as you guys said on that wonderful show, by the way.
Thanks.
And they're saying, you know, Joe Biden or, you know, one of the other moderates, maybe, you know, Klobuchar, are more reassuring and will bring in more independents. And you take a huge risk when you go off on the limb with someone like Bernie Sanders or even Elizabeth Warren. And so that is the problem, is there are two stories as to what the strategy should be, and that's not good. The second thing, and I sent you, I think, an email about that this morning, is you think that the voters who voted overwhelmingly in the end for Hillary Clinton in 2016, are really very happy with the struggle between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton that has erupted. They're not. They're really angry. I talked to some of them. They said Bernie Sanders is still the same guy that walked away in 2016.
But he didn't. See, that's the problem, is that he didn't. And the biggest story of that story isn't the Bernie bros that voted for Donald Trump. It's the Obama folks that voted for Barack Obama and voted for Donald Trump. So you can blame, you know, a couple of 100,000 people for going from Bernie to Trump. What about the millions that went from Obama to Trump? How does Hillary explain how she didn't make that sale?
That's interesting, but that's not how Hillary Clinton supporters feel, right?
I know.
They feel that Bernie Sanders really essentially sort of showed his back to Hillary after he lost the nomination and didn't really work hard, didn't go after the Bernie bros and tell them, guys, we have to support the Democrat because otherwise we get bad stuff. And so I think we are underestimating the bad blood that exists there. And if Bernie Sanders, has a lot of enthusiasm, yes, but also the more traditional voters who supported Hillary Clinton, they're really mad. And who knows who they're not going to vote for Bernie Sanders in the caucuses. I know that for sure.
How about in the general?
So they're going to sacrifice the country because they're still pissed off at Bernie. It sounds as trite as the Donald Trump supporters.
I don't know. I don't know what they'll do in November. I'm guessing that they will hold their noses and vote for the Democrats.
So Bill Curry came on the air the other day, and Bill Curry made a really good point.
Yeah.
Most of my progressive candidates have never made it into a general election.
Yeah.
I have never not voted for them, those people that I didn't really want. The other way around is I'm going to take my ball and go home.
Yeah.
And the moderates are saying, no, I don't like this Democratic Socialist. And the best storyline I heard, and I've said it three times, I'll say it four times. The woman in South Carolina, the black elected official who was with Biden, ended up telling and announcing she's with Bernie now. Mm-hmm. And she's a moderate corporate type, whatever. And they said, you don't like Medicare for All. You don't like the Democrat. So she said two things. She said, one, he appeals to young people, and he will expand the base. She likes what he's able to grow. That was the Elaine Godfrey story in The Atlantic.
Yeah.
You know, which way do you go? So she literally was with Biden and suddenly started looking at where Biden wasn't growing, but Bernie was growing. And she wants to be in a place where she can grow a Democratic voter as opposed to keep it stagnant. The other thing she said was so powerful and so prescient. She said, Bernie doesn't win in isolation. That means that Congress will temper what he does. So Bernie's going to talk about Medicare for All. He's going to bring in all these agendas. And you know what? The Senate and the Congress, they're going to bring them back to home. And that means that a lot of those policies will be moderated. So I'm not so worried about everything he does because I know what's in Congress. But
well,
I do know that he'll move us a bit in that direction. He won't retard moving forward. But what he won't do is get everything he wants because they won't let him.
And let me remind you, however, you and Elaine and others, that when you say young voters like Bernie Sanders, yes, maybe on college campuses, but there is a huge America with very young voters, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old, who are not liberal, who are not progressive, who are not supportive of any of those policies. And they're being recruited by the Republicans. And so you can't generalize about young voters because, you know, I live in a state where in my classes, half of the students are Republicans and half of the students are still good with
Trump. So let me just say something.
You have to include that in the, you know, in the mix.
So I'm going to sort of challenge you the way I challenge some of my climate deniers. But the fact of the matter is 64% of young people support a Bernie type candidate versus a Trump type candidate. OK, so if nothing else, yeah, they exist. I know they do. I've met young people who support Donald Trump. I get it. I don't know if there are enough of them. Number one. Number two, I don't know how sophisticated they are and how, you know, I mean, they may be recruiting them. Will they show up and vote? I don't know that answer either. But the other important story is the numbers that are coming out about African-American voters nationally. You know, Biden may have them in South Carolina, but guess what? When you look at African-Americans nationally, Bernie and Biden are almost neck and neck. So
that's
you
right.
combine the young vote, you combine the African-American vote, you combine what they're bringing in and the new people that are showing up, and that Bernie supporters are a little bit Trumpish-like. They're very, very passionate. It could be very interesting to see what happens in this election. I'm just telling you. And on
it will be. And I can tell you that in the last elections, in the whole cycle of elections going back, the precincts that have the largest number of students are the ones with the lowest turnout of voters.
We'll see what happens in 2020. We'll call and talk to you then. Thank you so much, Stefan Schmidt.
And we go out with Dirty Laundry by Don Henley.
Stefan Schmidt joins us every week from Iowa. Here we go, Dirty Laundry.